Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network with me, Naomi Fowler. Coming up later, we look at the booming business of passports and residency for sale.
Selling citizenship is just an interesting iteration of offshore, because essentially all you're doing is selling your sovereignty. The due diligence is outsourced, the marketing is outsourced, the country just puts its name on the passport and takes the cash. Every person they turn away on due diligence grounds is a person whose money they're not going to get.
We'll have more on that and why we should all be worried a bit later. This is edition 70 of the TaxCast, and this month we dedicate it to the memory of Daphne Caruana Galizia. She was an incredibly brave anti-corruption champion and investigative journalist who was murdered this month in Malta by people who put a bomb in her car. For years, she confronted the rot eating away at Malta and the weakening of state institutions head-on with her fearless blog, Running Commentary. Malta's Europe's smallest member state, described as a pirate base for tax avoidance inside the EU, and it's also a favourite mafia jurisdiction. It's ranked 27th in the Tax Justice Network's 2015 Financial Secrecy Index. The next ranking is due out in 2018. Daphne Caruana Galizia was central in Maltese reporting on the Panama Papers leak, and she exposed offshore dealings of prominent politicians in Malta. Her recent work alleged Russian bribes for the sale of Maltese passports. We join the Maltese people, her family, her colleagues and friends in honouring this great citizen. This is a cowardly attack on all those who refuse to accept the corruption and state capture of our institutions and democracies by dirty money and financial secrecy. In a statement, her three sons have called on the Prime Minister to resign after overseeing what they describe as a society dominated by fear, mistrust, crime and corruption. They also say, "We are not interested in justice without change. Justice will only be served when everything that our mother fought for, political accountability, integrity in public life and an open and free society, replaces the desperate situation we're in." We'll monitor this situation and bring you developments here on the TaxCast. We're going to speak now to the Tax Justice Network's John Christensen for his take on tax justice events this month. OK, John, this month the IMF has brought out an interesting report. Even they now agree that taxing the rich is really one of the key ways to tackle inequality. I mean, they're talking about redistribution through the tax system in this report. And yet, on the other hand, the same month, France's President Macron's latest policy announcement is demonstrating how far in the opposite direction many governments are going. He's planning to eliminate a wealth tax on yachts, racehorses, luxury cars, jewellery, private jets and all that sort of thing, in order to supposedly stem what is actually a mythical exodus of entrepreneurs and millionaires from France. It's going to cost France around $3.78 billion in lost revenue. The usual thing underlying that kind of policy, this very discredited idea that if you put more money in the pockets of the wealthy, it's somehow going to trickle down to other people, boost the economy and create jobs, and it's all good for everybody.
Yeah, and it's sad to see politicians, even young politicians like President Macron, relatively young, being so far behind the curve, because, and what we're witnessing here is a really important sea change in the global tax consensus. Now, if we go back to the 1980s and the 1970s, what we saw at that time were politicians and think tanks on the right wing of the political spectrum arguing that cutting taxes on wealth would stimulate investment and ultimately lead to even higher government revenues. Investment didn't increase. Tax revenues from capital fell significantly. And that, of course, caused governments to increase taxes on poorer households by increasing value-added tax and so on. And as investment levels fell, household incomes also fell. And this led to rising inequality and mounting household debt. And these outcomes are threatening economic and political stability. And that's the context in which the International Monetary Fund have come to this huge shift in their policy advisories. So the IMF is now talking about tax increases targeting wealth as being desirable and long-term beneficial. Specifically, they're talking about increasing capital gains taxes, extending them to cover a wider range of capital gains, and taxes on land and property, which in most countries are not taxed at all effectively. I would add that land and property owners in particular, think Donald Trump, benefit from the huge tax reliefs, the kind of commercial property reliefs that are applied to most property developers and so on. And many, if not all, of these reliefs could be simply abolished without causing any economic harm apart from to the wallets of a few already excessively wealthy people who use land and property to avoid paying taxes. Now, of course, the IMF proposals are causing huge backlash from wealthy people and their lobbyists, but we've had close to 40 years to test whether this theory has any basis in reality. And the evidence to date is fairly conclusive. The theory doesn't work in reality. Those with a long political memory will recall that President George Bush, the senior one, not the junior one, described the theory at that time as voodoo economics. And it turns out he was, of course, right. Conservatives now need to radically rethink their ideas.
Well, I didn't think we'd hear on the TaxCast that George Bush Sr. was right.
On the issue of describing it as voodoo economics.
Not only Macron is going in the opposite direction, but Trump, as you mentioned, you know, with his proposals with the estate tax, which is we'd call the inheritance tax, and, you know, of benefit to a tiny proportion of the population, including himself and his friends. What Piketty said, the economist who wrote the book Capital, you know, he was quite frankly speechless about Macron's decision. And he said, I'm quoting, "There is absolutely no sense in making tax gifts to groups who are old and wealthy and have already done very well in recent decades."
Yeah, I mean, Thomas Piketty is absolutely right. But one of the sad things about this is Macron was elected by people who wanted to see genuine change in France and were already concerned about inequality. And he's just repeating what has failed in other countries. And that, you know, Einstein talked about idiocy as being something where you keep repeating the same experiment, hoping to have different results. Why will France be any different from the United Kingdom or United States or other countries which have tried to use tax cuts to stimulate investment and it's failed? It's not going to work in France.
Right. And in terms of studies on inequality, there have been so many, but the economist Gabriel Zucman's done work not so long ago on how Russia and the United States are more or less the same now as world leaders in income and wealth inequality. And the UK is not very far behind, actually, on wealth inequality measures. And that is based on what we know is a wealth concentration which is very much underestimated. So, you know, it could be even worse than we think.
And very probably it is worse than we think. You see, at the heart of the American dream is this idea that anyone can pitch up in the United States, work very hard, make themselves and their family's fortune. And that's been the core of the, you know, the American ideas for a long time. But actually, this is just a dream. In reality, most workers in the US have to work really long hours. They take far shorter holidays than their European counterparts. And get this, have seen their household incomes fall by almost 5% in the last decade and a half, falling in real terms. But not everyone in the US is that unlucky. If we take a look at the really truly wealthy people in the US, not the 1%, but the 1/100th of 1%, we find that their share of household wealth has jumped from close to 7% in the last decade and a half to 11%, and get this, has quadrupled since the 1970s, which is, in other words, before Ronald Reagan became president. Now, just a few words of warning about these estimates. A very large proportion of global wealth now sits offshore in secrecy jurisdictions like Switzerland and Luxembourg and even the US. Estimates of the sums of personal wealth sitting offshore range from about $7 trillion, Zucman's estimates, to $36 trillion, Henry's estimate. I think that $7 trillion is definitely on the low side. And a huge proportion of this wealth is controlled through offshore trusts and foundations, and there's no way of knowing whether the real owners of this wealth live in the United States or in Europe or China or wherever. So estimates of wealth inequality largely tend towards underestimating the true scale of inequality. And even though Gabriel Zucman and his colleagues have tried very hard to incorporate offshore wealth into their estimates, my hunch is that wealth inequality in the United States is much worse than the numbers suggest. And that raises the question, what will it take to reverse the extraordinary growth of inequality and the collapse of household wealth for the vast majority of households in the United States?
Right, and it's interesting that after the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia pretty much copied the conservative tax policies of Reagan, and they introduced a flat tax rate in 2001, meaning that everyone pays the same no matter how much they earn. And one of the main drivers of inequality in Russia started right there. So, you know, for any proponents of the flat tax, you can see how that works itself out for most people.
Absolutely. And of course, it's not coincidental that many of the advisors that went into the former Soviet Union turned up in Moscow were advisors from the United States. But even before the period of perestroika, when Gorbachev was trying to move towards a normalized social democratic market economy on a European model, even before then, the Soviet elites had shifted so much of their wealth offshore. And of course, where did it end up? It went via Cyprus, through Luxembourg, to Britain. And so the Russian oligarchs, by and large, hold their wealth offshore in tax haven Britain, where there's a huge accumulation of Russian wealth. All the worst things were built in even before the fall of the Soviet Union, and it was doomed to fail right from the start.
Right, and there's as much financial wealth held by rich Russians abroad in the UK, Switzerland, Cyprus and similar offshore centres than is held by the entire Russian population in Russia itself. So there you are. Oh. It's quite staggering and disastrous.
Disastrous for Russia, and goodness knows how that one's going to work out. But I do remember sitting in Jersey in St. Helier in about 1982 when one of my former colleagues was over lunch was telling me that he just picked up a client, a Russian client, who had over 100 million of assets sitting offshore. And I said, how can you possibly expect that wealth will be legitimate? It's got to be stolen. And the answer was, well, it's money and the fees are going to be fantastic.
Yeah, right. Okay, and we've had some good tax justice news this month as well. The European Commission's ordered Luxembourg to claim back $293 million in taxes from Amazon after finding that the tax advantage that Amazon got from Luxembourg over other companies constitutes illegal state aid.
Good news, and yet here's a warning. And the warning is that we might be heading for a period of tax wars between Europe and the United States. Beginning of 2016, one of the FT's lead columnists wrote about the breakdown of the kind of consensus of the previous 60 years around taxing multinational companies and said, unless we fix this, there will be tax wars. And I think we are heading in that direction. These rulings, from a European perspective, obviously good news, but in Washington, they're not interpreting that way. Since the Lux leaks, that is the leaks from Luxembourg, from PricewaterhouseCoopers, since that hit the headlines in 2015, the European Commission has been investigating how these special tax deals between PricewaterhouseCoopers and its clients on the one hand, and on Luxembourg, the Luxembourg government on the other hand. Many, but not all of the companies under investigation are headquartered in the United States. Amazon has been one example, billed for almost $300 million, unpaid taxes arising from this special deal with Luxembourg. Apple's another big US giant. They've been ordered to pay the Irish government $15.2 billion of unpaid taxes. And the Irish government doesn't want to collect it. In fact, but they're refusing to do it. And they're now being told by the EU they have to collect that money. Now, viewed from Washington, these attempts by the European Union and Brussels to tax profits generated within the European single market is interpreted as hostile activity. One former Republican congressman, David Camp, has said the Europeans are targeting US dollars overseas that the US believes should be taxed here. And he goes on to say, I'm quoting this directly, we have to address this problem before the Europeans get there first. So, you know, it's seen as a very hostile activity, taxing US multinational companies. So Brussels is saying we want to tax companies, regardless of whether they're US or otherwise. If they're making profits here, they should be paying taxes here. The US position in the past has been, well, you know, we'll help protect our companies from paying taxes anywhere. So I can see this leading to a very nasty confrontation. What we're seeing is the end of a historically long period where US and European countries saw their role as to support their multinational companies by allowing them to get away with massive tax avoidance, thinking this would actually help them build up market share in other markets around the world. That period is now under challenge, not least from civil society organisations like Tax Justice Network, and it'll be interesting to see politically how this plays out.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Thousands of desperate people die every month trying to cross borders for a safer and a better life. But there's a booming industry that will open up pretty much all the borders you need, if you've got enough money to pay for it. This month, the TaxCast looks at residency by investment programmes and passports for sale.
Selling citizenship is just an interesting iteration of offshore, because essentially all you're doing is selling your sovereignty. This is actually a kind of tax havery, it's just a different kind of tax havery.
Journalist Oliver Bullow is about to publish a new book called Moneyland, which investigates this booming business.
There's a lot of people that make a lot of money out of this, but a lot of that goes to the people who organise it rather than the country per se. Essentially, the only ones that have really traditionally shifted significant volumes of passports are Dominica and St. Kitts. They have sold an awful lot. The basic package that all the Caribbean tax havens offer is that they have visa-free travel to the Commonwealth, visa-free travel to the UK and the EU, and then they may or may not have visa-free travel to Canada. Antigua does, St. Kitts doesn't. None of them have visa-free travel apart from Grenada to the US. In 2015, I think it was, the Prime Minister and St. Kitts said they'd sold 10,000 primary applicants. So on top of that, you've got some children, you know, people coming in alongside the primary applicants. So there would be much more than 10,000 St. Kitts economic citizens out there somewhere. Dominica has always been the bargain basement offering.
Right, and then there's St. Lucia, a new entrant into this race to the bottom, undercutting the rest, charging only $100,000 per applicant and a nice round $190,000 for a family of four. And then residency by investment is a bit of a different animal, right?
The big countries, you know, Britain, America, they sell residency. And if you want to buy it, you actually have to go and live in those places. They won't just sell you a passport, so you can go and live somewhere else. It's a related issue, basically, but it's a slightly different one. The same problems potentially apply to it, and it has a very similar history. There is a question of fairness about the fact that if you are a Syrian without money and you're trying to get into the European Union, then you're essentially going to be riding a rubber dinghy to try and get to Lesbos. Whereas if you're a Syrian with money and you want to go to the European Union, you can buy a residency in Portugal or buy a passport in Cyprus or a passport in Malta, and then you can just fly in through an airport. And I think the problem there is to look at who the people are from Syria or who the people are from China or who the people are from Venezuela who would be doing this. These are not necessarily the kind of people that you want in your country, who might be officials in a country oppressing their own people, earning money from their own people and stealing money from their own people, are able to use that money to buy access to the European Union or the United States or whatever, while the people who are being oppressed, the people who are being stolen from, are stuck. And the only way they would be able to get into the EU is as a refugee.
And the benefits of buying a second passport aren't just about freedom of movement, important though that is, in a world where some are so free to cross borders and others just aren't. There are also potentially big tax benefits.
Well, that's sort of the mammoth in the room. If people are essentially selling tax residency, then that means that, you know, a Russian billionaire's information will be exchanged not with the Russian Treasury, but will be exchanged, you know, with Antigua or Malta or whatever, places that, you know, where there's no particularly tax anyway. So it's just essentially a way of getting around the implications of the tax transparency rules, which is a real problem because, you know, those rules obviously have been a great advance and ways to try and stop people getting their money through the various loopholes in Switzerland and so on. And if essentially they've invented a new way of getting around that, then that system has been broken before it's even really come into force.
When you get a passport of another country, you could use that passport and you use your address in that country to open a bank account. And then it requires a bank to check that actually this is your second passport. You have another one and it's your second address, but you have another one. Yeah, how's the bank going to find out?
Francis Wetik of Oxfam Novib.
If the bank doesn't find out or if the bank turns a blind eye, that means you're cheating the system. You're supposed to give all your tax numbers and tax residencies and citizenships as information to the bank. They should know.
It's a money launderer's dream, a kind of flag of convenience. Some schemes you don't even have to go to the place you're becoming a citizen of, much less actually live there. And there's been scandal after scandal around the passport for sale business since it began. And it all started in St. Kitts and Nevis back in 1984. It remained small scale for a couple of decades, just a dozen passports a year sold by government insiders. But the idea spread. Now it's booming. So what happened to provoke it and why specifically has it been such a growth area, particularly for some of the Caribbean islands? Francis Wetik again of Oxfam Novib.
Over the past 2 or 3 years, there's been a major international push to get data on financial accounts exchanged so that the countries where rich people come from get information about their balances on foreign accounts, not just money, but also investments in financial assets, shares in companies and so on. It's been a bit uneven. The smaller jurisdictions have been under very high pressure to sign up to the international system. The small islands like Antigua and Bermuda or Seychelles or Santa Lucia, they all signed up. They've been under very high pressure. There are still a few holdouts, including the US, which hasn't committed to a certain date to start sending data itself, and also Hong Kong, the Bahamas and Panama, who haven't committed yet to signing up to the multilateral system for exchanging financial account data. But all these smaller jurisdictions have been under such pressure that they all signed up. Now that means that there's no big business for them anymore in just hiding information by not sharing it, because they can't do that anymore. So you can see that they are now trying to think of something else to extract a little bit of money from very wealthy people that want to hide their fortune. That's what's happening now.
And another important thing happened that boosted the passport for sale business. Enter stage right, Henley and Partners. Oliver Bullough.
The Jersey-based experts in citizenship and residency planning, Henley and Partners. In 2005, Christian Kalin, their chairman, went to St. Kitts and Nevis and basically said, look, you're in all sorts of economic dire straits. Your sugar industry has just been shut down because of a change in the way EU tariffs work. You really need some money. You have this law on the books that means you can sell passports. What you need to do is totally upgrade your business, make it reputable, make it look good. And they said, Henley and Partners said, look, just give that to us. We'll take care of all the marketing. We'll take care of all that. And all we want in return is every passport that sells, we get $20,000. So that was essentially how the St. Kitts passport scheme went mass market. It was changed from being a dodgy tax haven, just flogging passports to money launderers, to being essentially run by a Western company. The due diligence was entirely undertaken by Western companies. Essentially, all St. Kitts was really doing was actually just putting its name on the passports. It didn't actually really do anything particularly. So it was Henley and Partners that made it big. And so that's why the St. Kitts scheme went from selling about six or 10 passports a year to more than 2,000 a year. And then Henley has gone, taken that model of getting a commission for every passport sold, bringing in Western due diligence companies, and they've taken that to Malta. They took that to Antigua Barbuda. You know, that scheme is now copied by other competitors of Henley, Arton Capital and so on, who then take that to the other countries that sell passports. So the model is essentially the same, but the actual country does very little itself. The due diligence is outsourced. The marketing is outsourced. The country just puts its name on the passport and takes the cash. the big accountancy companies, they're all getting into this game now as well. So you know, how do you regulate them any more than they're already regulated? I mean, good luck with that, basically.
Francis Wasig.
What I find quite disturbing is that this firm, Henley & Partners, is on the one hand advising wealthy clients, and on the other hand advising governments, which makes it more likely that actually people are using the loopholes where they can, and that new loopholes are being opened up.
Right, and they do actually say second citizenship shouldn't be used for dodging tax.
It's much to their credit that they say you shouldn't use a second citizenship to do anything illegal, and you shouldn't just choose a second residence and pretend you live there while you're not really living there. But I doubt whether that's going to stop people from accusing it. And we don't know how big it is. We don't have a clue about to what extent this is about legitimate motives or much more dodgy motives.
Right, because it's a mixed picture when it comes to transparency. But what about the checks and balances? Due diligence. Oliver, what kind of diligence is employed by private companies who have an interest in pocketing your commission? Or at least you've got one firm of lawyers like the one you mentioned who are outsourcing that diligence to another company.
Well, I mean, it's sort of checks as what would be done by a bank looking to open a bank account. They will run people's names through the standard due diligence databases, the ones that are run by Thomson Reuters and so on. And if they come back with anything, then they put that in their report. And then the Citizen Investment Unit will make a call whether or not to refuse them. They will always claim to be adhering to the highest standards of checks and everything. But to be honest, there are so many stories about people going through the program being approved despite all sorts of scandals that it's hard to believe that there aren't corners being cut. You know, the head of the Antiguan Citizenship by Investment Unit, Sanger Chekwe, a Canadian guy, he quit after just 6 months in the job because he said the government was putting pressure on him to approve people that he didn't want to approve. So I think there's an awful lot of that involved. You know, every person they turn away on due diligence grounds is a person whose money they're not going to get. The transaction is not public, and there's always a temptation to try and cut corners and make a bit more money than you otherwise would. And time and again, journalists in China and elsewhere have checked the sort of agencies that run these sort of consultancy schemes, Chinese agencies that run consultancy schemes to help people buy passports. And they will state publicly that they help people forge the documentation in order to make it look like they don't have criminal records, or forge the documentation to make it look like they earned all their money legally and they've always paid their taxes legally.
Right, but if it continues on the trajectory that it is at the moment, and there don't seem to be any changes being made or any concerns from other countries who are going to be able to be accessed by people who perhaps may not have been checked out properly, this is going to become a bigger and bigger thing.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I was speaking to the Prime Minister of St Lucia, and he was saying, you know, he's very aware of the fact that if he sells a passport, essentially, he's not just selling a passport, he's also selling a visa to the UK and a visa to the EU and whatever, because that's essentially what a St Lucian passport is. It's kind of a super visa. But, you know, there's one thing being aware of that and another thing being prepared to forego the revenue that you would earn by selling that passport. So it's a loophole in international law, like any aspect of offshore, of the sort of legal status of offshore, in that essentially these places are sovereign. They can technically award their passport to anyone they want. The only limiting factor is whether that passport will allow you to get into other countries. And as long as the Commonwealth countries and the EU countries allow a St. Kitts citizen to enter visa-free, then they will keep selling the passports, and that's that. It would only be if they started being refused access that they might turn around and stop the business. I mean, as it is, there's no reason for them to stop.
It's probably fair to say that some of the Caribbean locations are challenged economically. They've just been virtually destroyed, some of them, by hurricanes. Some have also got these huge oversized finance sectors and yet impoverished populations on the whole. But this passport for sale stuff could be yet another strand of yet another round of business schemes that actually doesn't benefit the people living there.
Yeah, I think you can use the fact that the Caribbean islands are sort of remote and economically in trouble and are regularly whacked by hurricanes as an excuse for why they're doing this. But I don't, Malta and Cyprus don't have any excuses at all. They're just in it for the cash. They know that very few of the people who buy their passports actually go to live in Malta and Cyprus. So there's really no downside for them. I think that the emphasis now has to be on making sure that the schemes that do exist are properly run. That means, you know, really proper due diligence and that proper transparency in the schemes and in who the approved applicants are, transparency about how the due diligence is run.
Francis Wazig again.
It's not delivering for the majority of the people on those islands, really. And thinking of some alternatives that will benefit the people, I think that's needed anyway. You're talking about a lot of lost tax revenues. If governments can recoup only a little of that by closing down loopholes like second citizenship that's inappropriately used, it will save them in tax revenues. And that might well free up a little bit of resources. Maybe there's something that can be offered to the small islands that are now jumping into this and find a new way. I mean, look at these islands. Santa Lucia is in the business. It has just 180,000 inhabitants. Antigua and Barbuda, 100,000. Their GDP is in the single billions. How much can it cost to do some investments in a country with just 100,000 inhabitants to get its economy running on something else? It's like a small town. It's not something that countries can't afford because it will save them many more billions. It might also involve governments exchanging information more broadly. And then I think governments from all around the world should be really critical on whether banks have performed those checks adequately. The government should be able to find some way of scrutinizing the information where it's suspicious.
Oliver Bullough's book Moneyland is due to be published in 2018 by Profile Books. You've been listening to the Tatscast. We'll be back next month.